This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Duke Ellington was one of the great jazz composers of the 20th century. He wrote more than 1,500 songs and was a popular and influential band leader who left his mark on the culture and the country. Our guest, Terry Teachout, says that Ellington airbrushed key parts of his life in his autobiography, Music is My Mistress. Teachout, who wrote a biography of Louis Armstrong, tackles Ellington's enigmatic personality in his new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. While there's no getting around his musical talents, Ellington did not always share credits with his partners and had a complicated relationship with women, to say the least. Terry Teachout is drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, also critic at large for Commentary, and welcoming you back to Radio Times. Nice to have you back. I see what you've been doing for the last couple of years.
I've been keeping out of mischief.
Yes, you have. But did you write this book in any way to correct or even challenge Ellington's portrait of himself?
I don't think challenge is the right word. Most people who know anything about Ellington know that he was a person whose statements about himself couldn't be taken at face value. What I've tried to do is correct the historical record so that you can read my book and really know what he was like as a man, what his life was like, how things happened when they happened. But Duke was, I say somewhere in the book that he was a man who spoke not to reveal himself, but to conceal himself. And I think that sums it up pretty well.
In fact, you say his adoring younger sister said that he definitely wasn't direct when he wasn't direct with anybody about anything.
That's right.
Said he was not a straightforward person in a lot of ways.
And thus, he's not knowable. He didn't leave behind a diary. He didn't leave behind personal letters or like those wonderful private tapes that Armstrong left behind. To know him, you must see him in the eyes of other people and through his music, which is the real autobiography.
But you also say that no one really knew Duke Ellington.
No. Everybody says that, too. Everybody who was closely associated with him, friends, lovers, they all said the same thing, that they felt that they never really got through the barriers to find out the real man. And I think they were telling the truth.
Yeah. Do you know why there were barriers? I know you're not a psychiatrist, but...
And this is not a psychobiography.
And it's not a psychobiography.
But the answer to your question is, in part, Ellington comes from the black middle class of Washington, D.C., and he internalized its values, the desire for respectability. He believed devoutly in that, especially when he became a public figure, and he's a symbol of black pride and racial aspiration. He knows this, but he also knows that he wants to lead his life the way he wants to in private. And so right from the beginning, there's a disconnect between the public Ellington and the respectable public Ellington and the private Ellington, who is in the beds of, I suspect, thousands of women if an accurate count had been kept, and who became estranged from his wife not so long after they got married in the 20s.
And he sounds like he was called Duke at a pretty young age.
From childhood. There are different stories about it, but clearly, you know, his fellow students knew who the Duke of Wellington was. And from an early age, young Edward Kennedy Ellington was inclined to dress
very
well.
That was his name,
And to carry himself very elegantly. There's a wonderful story about how off to school in the morning, he'd come sweeping down the steps, dressed to the nines, down the stairs of the house, say to his mother, "Ah, this is the great, the glorious, the grand Duke of Ellington." And undoubtedly, something like that is where the nickname came from, and it stuck.
And do you think his family encouraged these dukely feelings?
Well, his mother certainly did. He was the quintessential example of what Freud said, which is that the condition for success in a man is that his mother should think that he is gifted without limit. And Ellington's mother absolutely thought, as we say back where I come from, that he hung the moon.
Yeah.
And so he went through life with this kind of internal security that came from that knowledge.
Do you think he was gifted in the way his mother did?
He was a genius. I just don't think there's any question about that. He was not a genius necessarily in precisely the way that we think. His reputation is complex. As you alluded to earlier, there are questions about, you know, who was involved with him in compositions. But put all these things aside, he's still the greatest jazz composer of the 20th century, one of the greatest American composers, period.
You say one of the supremely creative figures of the 20th century, but you also say a major composer, but not an influential one.
That's right.
Which I thought was interesting.
Well, to be influential, other people have to try to do what you do and imitate it, things like that. People played Ellington's songs, but they couldn't play the way his band played, because he wrote specifically for the individual musicians in the band who were themselves extremely original, idiosyncratic players. So you can write out an Ellington chart note for note, and they're published, you know. I mean, if you run a jazz band, you can buy an Ellington chart. But if you sit down and play it with your people, it's not going to sound the way that Ellington did when he sat down and played it with his people. And so his methods were not something that other musicians could really build on. And thus you have this interesting paradox, which is that he is the greatest jazz composer of the century, but he's not especially influential.
Do you think the fact that he was largely self-taught is a way to understand his genius?
Oh, yes. It has everything to do with it. And most people don't realize this. Ellington had maybe... We know he said he had about a half dozen harmony lessons, and he only took a handful of piano lessons. He worked everything out for himself. He did not listen to classical music. He didn't want to. He didn't think it was a good idea to. He wanted to develop his own gifts in his own way. And so he is, in the very best sense of the word, a homemade composer who worked everything out for himself.
You write, and I do want to play in just a moment or two, Mood Indigo, but you write, the band was his musical laboratory, a great good place where he experimented with new ideas, and he was incapable of functioning as a composer without its constant presence.
That is exactly right, and that tells us an enormous amount about Ellington. Every once in a while, somebody would write a piece about Ellington in the 50s or 60s and say, oh, this is our great composer. You know, we should give him $1 million a year and he can stay home and write music. He wouldn't have written a note if they'd done that. He could only write when he wrote it in the afternoon or in the middle of the night for the band to play that night or the next day. And he could experiment with it and tinker with it and change it. And he did that, too. Everything he wrote was adjusted on the spot.
In fact, you say he was a great procrastinator.
Oh, the worst.
I mean, I wonder if he was just driving his band crazy.
He drove everybody crazy he worked with. He was very funny about that, too. He said, you know, what I need to write music is a deadline. He's just like a journalist in that way. And, of course, the most spectacular example of this is the premiere of Black, Brown, and Beige, his Carnegie Hall debut, most ambitious piece he ever wrote. He starts writing it 6 weeks before opening night out on the road, and the ink was still wet when they premiered it at Carnegie Hall.
Well, and you know something about writing, having just written an opera, yes?
I sure do.
Well, I do want to play Mood Indigo, and this is 1930,
yes.
Composed with Barney
Bigard.
Bigard. Yeah. And let's listen, just it's about a minute and a half of Mood Indigo.
Okay.
Composed with Barney Bigard. We're talking about Duke Ellington, and you were telling me what Andre Previn said about this piece of music.
Yeah, Previn said that a guy like Stan Kenton could get up in front of a 100-piece orchestra and wave his arms, and they'd play this big explosion, and every studio arranger in Hollywood could say, oh yeah, he did this, this, and that. And Ellington gets up in front of his band and wags his finger, and three guys play a note, and Previn says, and I don't know what it is. And the piece he had in mind was this piece and that passage.
Well, and in the very beginning, it's that very muted sound, and we were talking as we were listening, and I mean, it sounds like the wind is blowing. It's almost uncanny.
Three in the morning music. I You shouldn't brag on what you write, but I wrote somewhere in the book that that passage is as indelible as a proverb.
He paid his band members well.
He paid them very well. Better than any other black band leader, and better than nearly all white band leaders.
And how would you describe his relationship with them? Because you also described that a number of them had drinking problems, drug problems, and he would kind of look the other way,
yeah,
right?
That's
sort
right.
of, it wasn't, I mean, he wasn't going to deal with it.
His attitude was, you know, he hired you because he wanted you. He wanted your sound. And as long as you could function, and he defined that pretty broadly, you know, you lived the life you wanted to lead. You know, there were a couple of episodes where he had to bail people out of jail. And he didn't fire, except on one spectacular occasion, he never fired anybody.
Wow.
But he could create a condition that would make you not want to stay in the band.
Oh, well, and what would that be?
Well, suddenly you're not getting any more solos, or, you know, it's just getting hot for you. But he did fire Charles Mingus one night when Mingus pulled a knife on Juan Tizol, and Tizol responded by getting an axe.
That would be a fireable
that
offense.
That was where he drew the line, yeah.
Tell us about his manager, a guy named Mills.
Irving Mills, a man for whom the word go-getter could have been invented. He heard the band in 1926. And this is at a time when Duke Ellington is not famous, is not well-known. He's just a band leader in New York. Mills heard them, and he was impressed by the music, and he was impressed by Ellington himself, and realized, I can take this man and I can promote him. Is not just your average jazz band leader, not just your average black band leader, but here is this fabulously elegant, charismatic, well-spoken man who is a composer. So Mills says, I will promote him as a composer, as the first great jazz composer. And this became central to the development of Ellington's public image. And permanently, this was how Ellington was thought of for the rest of his life.
Mm. He says about Ellington, Duke was a good listener. He followed instructions. He sponsored. He's got nothing to worry about, money or the job or the men.
That's right. Mills poured money into the band as an investment, because the deal was Mills cut himself in on the copyrights to Ellington's songs in perpetuity. So in return for this great upfront investment in the tremendous managerial skills, Mills makes money off Ellington for the rest of his life. And Mills lived into his 90s.
And he made a lot of money.
He made a lot of money.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Terry Teachout is our guest, and he's the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, also critic at large of commentary. The last time he was on Radio Times, we were talking about his book, Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. And in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about his brand new book, and it's called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and play some more music as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Winter Tour presents the 50th Annual Delaware Antiques Show, November 8th through the 10th at the Chase Center on the riverfront in Wilmington, Delaware, featuring 60 dealers specializing in American antiques and decorative arts. Highlights include a special lecture by internationally recognized interior designer and author Lady Henrietta Spencer Churchill. Delaware Antiques Show details and tickets are available at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Winter Tour proudly supports WHYY.
It's not about the pings, it's not about the dings, and it's definitely not about the mugs. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for what a successful membership campaign is about, supporting a new service that has your best interests in mind, whether on a global, local, or national level. We will invest your membership dollars right back into the news and programs that you expect from us. So thanks to you for making the campaign such a fabulous success. Thanks.
I'm George Takei. In 1938, families gathered in front of the radio at night.
Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds is the most famous radio broadcast of all time.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
And we're bringing it back for its 75th birthday.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Terry Teachout about the life and music of Duke Ellington. Let me play if it don't mean a thing, if it ain't got that swing, 1932 vocals by Ivy Anderson. Let's listen.
What da do, da da do.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And that was Ivy Anderson singing. And Terry, you say she was his first and best female vocalist.
I think without a doubt. She was just so hip, so swinging. And she had the attitude, that touch of irony, that touch of detachment, just fit in perfectly with the band. And in real life, although there's one surviving radio interview with her, and you can hear she's not genteel, but, you know, very well-educated woman. She was tough as nails out on the road. She was the band's poker shark. And down in the Deep South, if a cracker used the wrong word about her, he got a much worse word right back in his face, neither of which is usable on this show.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Let me go back to something, that quote from Irving Mills, Duke's manager. He goes on to say, Duke always knew his position, was always very grateful for everything that was being done because he knew he was getting all the best of everything. Everything we created was, quote, from the pen of Duke Ellington, whether he wrote it or he didn't write it.
Yes.
And this is the question mark that's hung over his head.
That's right. I mean, it's complicated. The book talks about it in greater detail than it's ever been discussed before. But to put it very simply, Ellington's instrumental compositions, they are normally by him. His pop songs, very often, and these are the familiar songs, right, like Moody Indigo, Sophisticated Lady, those songs, very often the melodic material comes from members of the band. And Ellington has put it together into compositions. He scored it. He might write the bridge. Sometimes the band members got credit. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they got royalties. Sometimes they didn't. And in order to understand Ellington's compositional process, you have to understand this fact.
Was he a synthesizer, a plagiarizer?
He was not a plagiarizer. You know, plagiarism implies theft without the knowledge of the person who's being robbed.
Right.
I think of him in the way we think of Orson Welles and his contribution to Citizen Kane. Welles tried to pass himself off as the author of the script. He didn't write it. He edited it. The visual look of the film is very dependent on the cinematography of Greg Toland. Welles is the director and the star, what we now in film theory call the auteur, and he signs the film. Ellington is the auteur of everything that the Duke Ellington Band performs. Sometimes he is its composer, plain and simple. Sometimes it's more complicated than that.
Mm.
But in the end, he's the guy who always signs it, and he is the guy who is ultimately responsible for its total effect.
Because he's the guy that orchestrates it,
That's right. And he didn't orchestrate everything the band played. You know, he did use orchestrators. Billy Strayhorn, whom we'll talk about later, plays an important role in that. But it's Ellington music, always, always, always.
You mentioned Sophisticated Lady. I'd actually like to play that, composed with Lawrence Brown and Otto Hardwick, and we'll talk about what they said about Ellington and this particular song. And this is from 1933. Let's listen. Sophisticated lady, and you include in your book, Terry, that as we said, Otto Hardwick and Lawrence Brown, what, largely responsible for this song, or perhaps it's hard to know as we turn the clock.
We can know exactly because they both told us. In what we just heard, Brown, who was a trombone player, wrote the trombone theme that you heard. The clarinet part that you heard was written by Otto Hardwick. They wrote these two pieces of melody, 8-bar pieces, separately. It was Ellington's idea to put them together into a 32-bar song. He orchestrated it, created the musical structure. And then he offered them, reports vary, but I think $25 a piece for all the rights to the song. And they took it. So on the very first recording, what we just heard of Sophisticated Lady, you see all their names on the label. Forever after, you only see Duke Ellington's name on the label. And Brown never forgave him for it.
And just held a grudge?
Held a grudge. Lawrence Brown had other reasons to hold a grudge against Duke Ellington, but this was one of the main ones, and he held it for the rest of his life.
And what were the other reasons?
Women.
Oh. I was going to... Well, let's get into the women part of
this
story.
A theme that will come up recurrently throughout this hour.
Well, Duke Ellington did marry, although yes. It didn't sound like a particularly happy marriage.
Had to get married as a teenager. Right. And at that point, or shortly thereafter, he discovered that his... interests ranged more widely.
And you're being very, very...
He started catting around. There, that's the technical term for it. And in somewhere around 1927 or 28, we can't pin it down exactly. I did a lot of research on this. He is now starting to become famous, and a large number of women are passing through his bed, including an extraordinarily beautiful actress named Freddie Washington. And one night, he's up in the Harlem apartment with Edna, his wife. In bed, and she pulls a razor and says to him, "I know what you've been doing, and I'm going to spoil those pretty looks." And she slashes his left cheek. He's out the door, doesn't even take his clothes, never comes back, and never comes back to her ever. And lived with that scar for the rest of his life. When you're sitting at a piano, you're showing your right side to the audience. So he wore stage makeup to conceal the scar on his cheek. But the cover of my book contains one of the very few photographs where that scar can be seen very clearly.
And coming out of his sideburn and sort of going towards his mouth.
Crescent-shaped. And it was a permanent reminder to him of what women can do to you if you mistreat them. But it didn't stop him from mistreating them. It just caused him to do it more cleverly.
But he never divorced her, which
is
interesting.
He never did. They were, and it was a matter of, for her, obviously, it means for the rest of her life she's Mrs. Duke Ellington and he's supporting her. For him, she was his ace in the hole. Whenever he got in too deep with a woman, he could just say, "Well, you know, I've got Edna. I've got she was his get-out card for all sorts of dilemmas, and he had plenty of them.
What did he think of women? Is there any way to know?
There are differing opinions about that. Mercer, his son, amazingly said he thought he hated women. I think he had what psychologists call the Don Juan complex. He couldn't get enough of them, but he was distrustful of them. He didn't want them to get too close, didn't want them to know him, but he couldn't do without them at the same time, partly because women and the act of sex specifically inspired him as a composer. He tells us this over and over again. He actually wrote a piece for Ebony in the 50s about, you know, the beauty of the sex act, what he called the sex symphony. And he wasn't kidding. There's a composition he wrote called Warm Valley. It's a beautiful, gorgeous ballad. That title's not a geographic reference. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, but the actual, I mean, I think sex has inspired many people to do many things. But you're saying the sort of act of sex was an inspiration for him.
It was, for him, sometimes inspirational. And the personalities of women themselves, he was obsessed with them in every sense of that word, the good senses, the bad senses. They were just, Irving Mills said it. He always had to have a woman. He always had a woman here, a woman there. He would come into some towns and he'd have several women all in different hotel rooms, in different hotels.
Giving them different keys. And
correct.
Then he would, behind yes. door number one,
that's
door number
right.
two.
That's right. He was that kind of guy.
Well, I think you also wrote that he also, and obviously had a complicated view of women, saw them as pursuers or huntresses. So
yes.
that they were sort of hunting him down.
That's right. He talks about that on the occasions when you think he's talking candidly, and sometimes he did. Yeah. He would often say that about women. And also he would say that they could be a trap, that your relations with women could trap you. And after Edna took the razor to him, he was very careful for the rest of his life not to put his foot too far in the trap ever again.
And that's Terry Teachout, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, titled very simply, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And Terry Teachout is a theater critic for the Wall Street Journal, also critic at large of commentary. And we're talking about the life of Duke Ellington. We're playing songs as well. In fact, I do want to play Coco. And
yeah.
I'll be honest with you, I was not particularly familiar with this song. You think it's one of his best.
I think it's the record that sums him up most completely in its 3-minute span. To me, it's the if a guy who writes 1,700 songs in his lifetime can have a quintessential composition, I think this is it.
What should we listen for? We're going to play about a minute and a half.
It's a blues, and you may not realize that at first. It's in the minor key. It's full of complex harmonies, dissonances, but also it'll swing you into bad health. It's just all these things put together into this single, beautifully unified, tight composition that just goes like a freight train from start to finish.
And we want to be swung into a bad health?
I like it.
Okay. Well, let's listen. This is Coco, Duke Ellington. Excerpt of Coco, composed by Duke Ellington, and that's Duke Ellington on piano, and you can hear it sort of in the background there.
Yeah, yeah, and yet that's the last piece of seasoning that goes into this dish that adds the piquant flavor to it. It's written out, you know, not his piano part, but the rest of this. People think, oh, jazz, improvised music. Every note of Coco is written out except for Ellington's piano part.
Wow.
He sits down and suddenly stuff starts to happen.
And he was influenced in many ways by the kind of stride piano, or what do you hear in his
piano?
Well,
he grew up with ragtime and stride piano. That was the kind of piano he started with, just like Count Basie did. And then as the century moved on, he simplified that striding left hand and becomes a much more modern-sounding pianist. And here in Coco, which was recorded in 1940, those are very modern harmonies that you're hearing. They are actually bitonal harmonies, like Stravinsky uses in The Rite of Spring.
Oh, wow.
Two keys stacked on top of one another.
Well, let's talk about Billy Strayhorn, yeah. And also a pianist, and born in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Had a classical training, it sounds like.
Unlike Ellington, he was classically trained and imagined at first that he would be a classical musician. But, of course, that was not really a serious option for a black man in America in the 1930s. He discovered jazz, listened to Art Tatum, then heard Ellington and heard his destiny calling. And a friend of his wangles a backstage invitation for him to meet Ellington in 1939. I think it may have been in Philadelphia, come
really?
To think of it. And so Strayhorn, this very nice, well-mannered, mild-mannered young man, comes backstage, sits down, and plays an Ellington tune. It may have been Sophisticated Lady. He plays it first in the style of Ellington and then in the style of Strayhorn.
Wow.
And then he plays a song of his own, which just happens to be Lush Life.
Which he wrote
as
a young
teenager.
Age.
And Ellington says to him, I want you to be part of my organization. You're going to come to New York. You're going to come to my house. Here's how you get to my house. You get on the subway. You take the A train up to Harlem. Well, Strayhorn stores that bit of information in his head and later will, of course, write Take the A Train, which mm-hmm. became Duke Ellington's theme song. But he comes to New York, becomes involved with the band, and very quickly ends up becoming essentially Ellington's closest musical associate. He writes music for the band. He writes arrangements of pop songs, his own compositions. They become very close. The relationship is essentially a father-son relationship because Strayhorn's own father was abusive. But it's far more complicated than that because Billy Strayhorn is homosexual. Mm-hmm. And at this time in American life, a homosexual who wants to lead an out life cannot lead a public life. And Strayhorn realizes, I'm consciously or not, these are things that you just gradually fall into. This is the way he can live his life, is he can write music for the Ellington Band, but not appear with them, doesn't tour with them, he's not seen with them. He sends the music in, he works with Ellington, he's at the recording sessions. So he can have his private life, and Ellington can be the great public figure in front of the band. But unfortunately, when you make a deal like this when you're in your 20s, you may look up in your 40s and decide that it's not working for you. And Strayhorn gradually realized that he was unknown, completely unknown, because Ellington is this colossally charismatic figure, and people are assuming that he writes everything, including music that Strayhorn wrote. That complicated the relationship greatly and always would.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and we'll get back to Take the A Train. And again, Terry Teachout, our guest, we're talking about his new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. More music and conversation after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Master's Degree in Nonprofit Leadership from the University of Pennsylvania. Now accepting applications for both full and part-time admission. The Nonprofit Leadership Program at Penn. Imagine, achieve, lead. Details at npl.upenn.edu.
Standing on the corner.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Lou Reed, who died Sunday at 71. We'll talk with Bill Bentley, who was Reed's longtime friend, worked as his publicist, and wrote liner notes to some of his recordings. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
You know, those are different times.
Senator Bernie Sanders says, I told you so, regarding unbridled U.S. electronic spying.
How are we going to have the kind of cooperation that we need when there is massive mistrust now against the United States for this type of spying?
Europe not amused by new revelations of NSA spying. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Many residents in our region, especially along the Jersey Shore, are still recovering from Superstorm Sandy. I'm Dave Heller. Join us Tuesday at 6 for a special Newsworks Tonight broadcast as our region marks the first year anniversary of the storm.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Terry Teachout is our guest. He was last on the show when he wrote a book called Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. He's got a new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, and we're playing selections from a number of Duke Ellington tunes, including Take the A Train, which I guess was kind of a theme song for Duke Ellington. And this is Betty Roche and Billy Strayhorn on piano.
Let's
listen.
Hurry, 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 take the A train to find the quickest way to get to Harlem. If you should take the A train, you'd find you'll get where you're going if you hurry. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Now it's coming. Ooh, ooh. Can't you hear? The rails are humming. Get with it. If you should take the A train, you'd find it. You get where you're going if you hurry.
Oh man, that's good stuff.
It sure is.
That's Betty Roche, and this is a quote from Duke Ellington. Said she had a soul inflection in a bop state of intrigue, and every word was understandable despite the sophisticated hip and jive connotations.
That is such an Ellingtonian line.
Is it? Does that sound like the Duke?
Yes, he did like to play with words. But he got her right. She was hip as could be.
And this was his theme song.
Yes. The band played it once or twice a night from 1941 when Strayhorn wrote it for the rest of Ellington's life.
And with Strayhorn, I mean, how you talked about a previous collaborator who essentially was angry at Ellington for the rest of his life.
That was Lawrence Brown, yeah.
Yeah, but same for Billy Strayhorn?
It was more complicated than that. I mean, the paternal relationship, the real intimacy, they parted company for a while in the 50s, but it was never sundered, but it was what you expect to happen when the gifted boy grows up and becomes a man and wants to lead his own life and doesn't quite know how.
Yeah. Was Ellington in any way put off by the fact that the Strayhorn was gay? Was that an issue for him?
Doesn't seem to have been, although Ellington, you know, he looked askance at some homosexuals. He actually... Now, I have to use this word to tell the story, but he actually would complain that there was a faggot mafia in the entertainment industry. They'd only hire their own. But he wasn't talking about Strayhorn. There were members of the band who were dubious about Strayhorn's sexuality, but there were others who just accepted it straight off, and I think mostly they did. Jazz musicians, as a rule, are a pretty tolerant lot.
You have some pictures, and you write about when they went to perform, they meaning the band, went to perform in the South. They had a Pullman car.
Pullman car.
Right. So they couldn't stay at the segregated hotels, right. Or I guess wouldn't stay at the segregated hotels, but they had this lovely Pullman car.
Yes, much fancier. And so, of course, the Southerners would be stunned by this band coming through, and they'd ask Ellington about it, and he would say in his grand manner, "Well, that's the way the president travels."
Is that a quote?
That is a verbatim quote.
He was a fancy dresser.
He was the fanciest of dressers, and it wasn't just a matter of personal preference. It was a matter of understanding that this was how he wanted to present himself, as an extraordinarily charismatic, successful man who could change his suits three times during the gig if that was what he wanted to do. And the band was dressed in its earlier years the same way. In their later years, things started to get a little seedier because it wasn't as important. But in the 30s and 40s, when the lights would come up on that band on stage, people would just gasp.
Oh. You have a picture here, and he's surrounded by suits and looks like makeup and all sorts of things. In the 30s, he traveled with five trunks of clothes plus a separate trunk for his shoes.
That's right. That's right. He did love the shoes. And he was a very superstitious man, and one of his superstitions was that if a button came loose on any garment of his, he would give it away rather than wearing it again or changing the button.
And why was he so superstitious? And he was.
Yeah, nobody really knows. I mean, it may just have been that he was so pampered by his mother that when he got into the world, you know, I mean, there was a touch-me-not aspect to him. But, you know, he had favorite colors and colors he couldn't stand and just bizarre superstitions. Hmm. And of course, it is related. He was, in his very idiosyncratic way, a very religious man.
I want to play an excerpt of Black, Brown, and Beige. This is called The Blues. But first, help us understand the importance of this piece of music.
Ellington is one of the first jazz composers who tries to work on a large symphonic-like scale. Black, Brown, and Beige is his most structurally ambitious composition. It's a 45-minute large-scale piece written for his Carnegie Hall debut in 1943. The subtitle is A Tone Parallel to the American Negro, And that's what the title means. This is a portrait in sound of the history of the American black from the African emigration through slavery to what was then the present moment, World War II. And the movement we are going to hear is called the blues, and it's Ellington's epitome of the blues in black life.
And again, vocals by Betty Roche. Let's listen.
The blues ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing but a cold gray day, and all night long it stays that way. Ain't something that leaves you alone, ain't nothing I want to call my own. Ain't something with sense enough to get up and go. Ain't nothing like nothing I know. The blues.
And again, an excerpt of Black, Brown, and Beige, composed by Duke Ellington. Lyrics by Duke Ellington as well. And again, that beautiful voice of Betty Roche. The blues ain't nothing.
Yeah. Dark, dark harmonies, too, and dissonant ones. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. You know, Ellington didn't borrow this from anybody, but you could listen to that and say, oh, Schoenberg, oh, Bartok. You know, I mean, your ear is immediately caught by these clashes of tonalities in a jazz composition from 1943.
And what did the critics have to say about Black, Blue, and Black, Brown, and Beige?
They blackened and blued it. Some
did
of them
they?
Did. They were all over the map. The ones who, back then, most of the people who wrote about this concert were classical reviewers, because you didn't have jazz reviewers in the newspapers yet. Some of them knew about jazz, dug what was going on. Some of them were utterly clueless. The reviews were all over the map. Ellington was deeply discouraged by them. He never again played the entire composition beginning to end after 1943.
After that Carnegie Hall
after
concert?
That, yeah.
Wow.
Tough.
I do want to play another excerpt, and this is actually jumping ahead to 1956 at the Newport Jazz Festival, but I'm curious about, so what happened between 43 and 56?
Well, World War II ends, the big band era ends, suddenly it's a world of pop singers like Sinatra, and then it becomes a world of youngsters like Elvis Presley. Where is the place for a guy like Duke Ellington in this changed world? And the answer is the gigs are starting to dry up. He's having actually a rather rough time of it. People are seeing him as history. He gets booked into the third Newport Jazz Festival in 56. Not a very good place on the program either. He's bringing up the rear, actually. So he comes on the bandstand. Everybody's saying, oh dear, it's Duke. He pulls out this piece, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, written in 1937, turns the band loose on it. They go wild. Paul Gonsalves, the tenor sax soloist, plays, I think, 27 straight blues choruses in the middle of it. By the end of it, people are dancing in the aisles. They're shrieking. They go mad. 2 weeks later, Ellington's on the cover of Time magazine. Mm. And for the rest of his life, the dead letter of jazz is suddenly the most famous band leader in the world, and he stays that way.
Let's listen. This is a Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue from the Newport Jazz Festival, 1956.
Thank you.
concert at the Newport Jazz Festival, 1956, a diminuendo and crescendo in blue. Someone posted on our Facebook page to you, Terry. I think this is one of his best live performances. Would you agree?
It's just hot as sin. You can see why they went wild. And you can hear Ellington in the background. He's yelling. He knows what's happening out there in the audience. And I think probably deep down inside, he knew what it was going to mean for him.
Which was, he was sort of back on the
instantaneous
covers.
Revival of his career. It was one of the two great moments, I think, of his career. This was the bookend, the one that revived him, and then you've got to go all the way back to the Cotton Club in 1927 for the other one.
In fact, I didn't ask you about the Cotton Club, and I should have, and one of the things that you write in the opening chapter about it is, in 1927, Harlem was a playground for white people who could afford to pay for liquor and sex, and who liked having sex with black people so long as they didn't have to talk to them afterwards.
Right, that's what it was like. And Ellington played at a segregated club in the middle of Harlem, where blacks provided the entertainment, but to which they were not admitted. This is the Cotton Club, the famous nightclub, run by mobsters, run by a multiple murderer, Oney Madden. And it was the biggest break that Ellington ever had, because the Cotton Club had a network radio broadcast wire from CBS. So suddenly this Harlem band leader is playing. He's heard across the United States 2-3 times a week, and the world opened up to him because of those Cotton Club performances.
Well, let me segue from that to a soundtrack that he wrote in 1959 for the film Anatomy of a Murder. And this is the main title. So it's a different, you can hear some of what we've been listening to.
That's
when
right.
It comes to Duke Ellington.
This
but
is what
a
you
little,
hear under the credits. Yeah.
Let's listen. And the main title from a soundtrack to a 1959 Jimmy Stewart film called Anatomy of a Murder, composed by Duke Ellington. A lot going on in that piece of music.
It's very hot. And, you know, touches of the rock and roll, from that backbeat, those triple figures in the drums. I mean, you can hear that Ellington's ears are wide open.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, you wrote a book about Louis Armstrong, a book about Duke Ellington. Compare, contrast. I mean, it seems like very different people, very different composers.
Bookends, but totally different, opposite sides of the coin. Armstrong is a completely open person. You feel that you can know him, that you want to know him. I never met anybody who knew him who didn't love him. Ellington is opaque. Ellington conceals himself. Ellington is a cautious man when it comes to his relations with the world. And that made this book in some ways harder to write.
A bigger challenge
bigger
to try
challenge.
To sort of figure out who this person was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been a great pleasure once again to have you with us on Radio Times.
For
Thank
me
you
as
very
well.
Much.
Thank you for having
You're
me.
You're very welcome. And Terry Teachout, our guest, a drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, also critic at large of Commentary. And as I said, wrote a book about Louis Armstrong called Pops, and his new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we want to close things out with a recording back from 1942. And again, this is Duke Ellington and a song called Perdido. Let's listen.